Вчера появился фальшивый твиттер-аккаунт.
Это не единственный такого рода фейсбук-скандал на сегодня. Появились слухи об обысках...
Я могу от имени любого человека все что угодно. Фальсифицировать в интернете...
Там, решил подать заявление об отставке. Вписал... Фальшивый Дворкович. Отдельное спасибо Дмитрию Анатольевичу.
It looked like pretty big news at the time. Deputy Prime Minister Arkady Dvorkovich announced his resignation last month on Twitter. The move came, or appeared to come, in the midst of a high-profile battle with Rosneft CEO Igor Sechin for control of Russia's energy sector, and it briefly set Russia's political world on its ear. There was just one problem. It wasn't true. Dvorkovich quickly made that clear on Facebook. He informed the public that the Twitter account announcing his resignation was, in fact, a fake. He remains in office, but will anybody believe his Twitter feed again? Also last month, a slickly produced video accusing Dmitry Medvedev of selling out Russia's interests in the Middle East popped up on a YouTube account registered to Deputy Prime Minister Dmitry Rogozin. It sort of made sense. Rogozin is widely believed to covet Medvedev's job as prime minister. But then it didn't make any sense at all. Rogozin quickly announced on Twitter that not only did he not post the video, but he doesn't even have a YouTube account. Confused? Well, that's the point. Provocation, diversion, and subterfuge have long been staples of political struggles in Russia. It's called pakhazuka in Russian, and it tends to be used more frequently in periods of political uncertainty, like now, for instance. Shadows, whispers, deception, and agitprop. An age-old Russian art form has entered the digital age. If you think you can believe your eyes and ears, think again. Hello, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me in Prague is my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, of RFERL's Russian service. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello.
And on the Skype line from New York City is somebody familiar with games of shadows and whispers. Mark Galliotti is a professor at NYU, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, guys.
Mark, let's start with you, since you're the expert on these kinds of matters. These games, diversion and subterfuge, of course, happen in all countries. They're not unique to Russia. But in Russia, they seem to be something of an art form. Are the Russians just better at this than anybody else? Why is this the case in Russia?
Well, I think it's really the case that they get more used to it. I think there's three reasons why this is such a factor. The first is we've got to consider the nature of the political system. This is not one in which politics actually gets carried out through institutions, through parliament and such like. In many ways, politics is personalized. It's about the court of Tsar Putin. And therefore, the key resources are access to Putin, authority, credibility. And therefore, I think they use a lot of these sort of rumors and whispers and all kinds of sort of shuffling of the deck of kompromat as part of the political struggle between elements of the elite, attempts to tarnish other people's reputation, attempts to make people look weak and ineffectual and therefore not particularly good candidates for Tsar Putin's favor. So, I mean, I think that's one factor. Just this is the nature of how politics happens. The second thing is, I mean, I think quite often these kinds of exercises are as much as anything else trial balloons. They are attempts to see if there is a consensus about elevating or more often demoting some particular individual. I mean, we saw that in a slightly different context with the whole Bastrykin walk in the woods mm-hmm. business, in which it's clear that the FSB leaked information about Bastrykin going off the deep end and threatening a journalist and such like, in part because they were hoping that they could oust him. They couldn't actually just simply say, look, we think Bastrykin should go, because that is outside of the etiquette of the elite. But instead, they embarrass him, and they see whether or not Putin withdraws or continues to support. In this context, Bastrykin was able to be supported. So it was a way in which you can actually manage these politics without actually having to openly say anything. And the third element is just habit and idiom. You know, all political systems have their quirks. All political systems have their different ways of working. And this is one that, let's face it, dates back. It's not just a Putin-era thing. It's a Yeltsin-era thing. It's a Soviet-era thing. It goes back to the Tsarist era. You know, given that the successive different sort of iterations of Russian politics have been courtly politics, we shouldn't be surprised that we see this same kind of idiom cropping up.
Kirill?
Well, first of all, I totally agree with Mark's statement that one of the main reasons of this, you know, stream of various provocations and, you know, play games with public opinion and so on is that this field of provocation, political provocation, is the only room for something fresh and initiative and innovative in Russian politics. So it's a very interesting psychological thing. If you want to do something new, really, or say something really new, you are inside this field of provocation, not in the, you know, particular political field, you know, established political field and so on. You are in, you know, some kind of muddy waters of, right, of this. Another point, first of all, we live in digital age when no one can prove anything. And we can, you know, I can just, you know, post in my Facebook that, you know, Putin and Navalny have been seen in some Moscow restaurant and I'll have, you know,
we can try
1,000 likes in a second, you know. And I can post even a picture, a photograph of them sitting, so two backs, you know, eating some lasagna or something
well,
like
it's,
this.
Well, it's interesting you raise that because there was an interesting case with Navalny, if you remember correctly, last year, a newspaper, I believe in Yekaterinburg, posted what it says were photos of Navalny with Boris Berezovsky in an attempt to discredit Navalny. It turned out they were photoshopped, and the photo actually had Navalny with Prokhorov, which would not have discredited him. And the whole thing backfired on whoever the provocateur was. I assume it was the authorities, because it created an internet meme of photos of Navalny with Arnold Schwarzenegger and space aliens and everything
by
else.
By the way, we all seen Gerard Depardieu with Kadyrov. Could you imagine such a picture, you know, 10 years ago?
I saw one today of, incidentally, with Kadyrov with Gene Simmons from KISS. Actually.
Yes, it was great.
One of your colleagues in the Russian service showed that to me. Well, Kirill, you mentioned the digital revolution, and Mark, you mentioned how this is nothing new in Russia. This does, in fact, go back to the Tsarist times in different forms. How has the digital age and social media, the social media revolution, changed the game? I guess, Mark, let's go to you first.
Yeah, I think what it's changed is precisely the way in which, once upon a time, again, if we go back to sort of Soviet days, yes, quite often we would see rumors and kompromat being floated or at least sort of delicately alluded to in roundabout terms. But on the whole, you knew exactly where it was coming from. If something was in Krasnaya Zvezda, you knew it was that the military was seeking to push a certain line. If it was in Pravda, then you knew it was someone within the party apparatus. Precisely what's happened is now that you have the, I suppose, what's the opposite of the kiss and tell, the hiss and tell, sort of approach that you can at least claim deniability. You know, you can say, good Lord, no, I have no YouTube account. And no one can really prove otherwise. In some ways, it's actually closest to, if you think back to Venice in the Renaissance, where you had these sort of lion's mouths in which any citizen could just put an anonymous denunciation and it would be read by the sort of the secret police. In some ways, that's what the internet is now. It's that opportunity where you can throw anything you want into the mix. And again, we go back to this business of it being a trial balloon, see if it works. I mean, clearly someone thought that having the Navalny Berezovsky photo was a clever idea. And presume, I mean, unless we're going to start going into the complete conspiracy theories of sort of, well, it was actually sort of people close to Navalny convincing him to look discreet. Well, look, let's not go that way, because otherwise we descend into madness. But certainly it is one of these cases where, precisely because of the sort of the proliferation of platforms on which you can put this information, the opportunities for, you know, where what once was a complex art of airbrushing out photos, now anyone in, you know, in their back room with a Photoshop can do it. It means that actually it becomes easy to just throw this stuff out and just precisely see if, metaphorically speaking, it gets lots of likes.
Right. No, I mean, in preparing this, I was reminded of some of the billboards. This is the early digital age, the 90s, but not quite where we are now. But in the 90s in Moscow, if you drove down Rublevskaya Chasse, which I had to take a taxi down that road every day to get to work, you'd see billboards that would have the most inexplicable messages on them. Now, much of the elite goes down that road as well. And one I remember, it was directed against Roman Abramovich, and it, I knew what it was all about, but I would imagine like a lot of the public was scratching their heads. It said, "The family takes care of Roman, and Roman takes care of the family, and Roman's found a cool spot." That's all it said. It didn't say Abramovich. It said, "The family takes care of Roman. Roman takes care of the family." This is a huge billboard in like one of the most elite real estate sections of Moscow. Is the public, I mean, what does the public think when they see these things? Do they just brush it off, you got to wonder? Or is it?
I think they even just didn't notice them.
Right.
And that's all. Because everything you look at every day, you just forget about its just existence,
right.
I think so. As for this, the new digital era of Russian and, world politics, I'll continue Venetian idea of Mark, because there are a very interesting traditions in Russian politics, traditions of provocation.
Mm-hmm.
It began, I think, with the secret police in the end of 19th century. And don't forget that the very beginning of first so-called First Russian Revolution in 1905 began with the provocation, because this Bloody Sunday partly was a result of a provocation from secret service.
Mm-hmm.
Don't forget about this, all this Gapon movement and first Russian trade unions, which were founded by secret agent Zubatov.
Mm-hmm.
And these traditions are very strong. And I'm not sure that they were strong during the Soviet times, because we had an ideology and a totalitarian state instead of provocation.
Right.
Yes, of course, there was a room for provocation in Soviet politics, but in a full swing, it returned from Yeltsin times and still now.
In a big way.
Yes, and now we have a very interesting situation when Russian, lost art of provocation marries Venetian style of digital era.
Venetian style
yes.
of digital era. I'll let you go. I'm not going to even get in here. Go ahead. Continue.
Okay. So that's why I think all these provocations, all these games around Facebook and Twitter and everything, YouTube activity is so intense and so strong. Moreover, it's very interesting that if we look at kind of dual mm-hmm. system of Russian politics or Russian, public sphere, we'll see that both parts of the game are very strong in provocations.
Oh, yeah.
Both of them. It's very important. Not just Arkady Mamontov, who, shot all this propaganda
that we'll talk about
documentaries
in the
and
this,
so
yeah.
on. But if we look at the opposite side, so-called liberal or democratic side and so on, we can find a lot of fakes in mm-hmm. their statements, in their, all these Facebook posts and pictures.
Well, again,
and
back
so
to Navalny.
On.
Remember the leaflets he posted on doors about from the Party of Thieves and Swindlers on what looked like the official United Russia stationery. So.
Yes. So in some sense, it's very funny and very effective in some sense. But for a serious, you know, perspectives of Russian politics and Russian society, I think it's very dangerous. It's very dangerous because everyone looks at, you know, any people around him with the suspicion.
Yeah. Well, this is, you touched on something I did want to discuss, and that is one of the ways the current era seems to be changing this is that the authorities have lost their monopoly to do it. The security services used to be the best at this. Are they losing their monopoly on there? Are they losing their dominance of this, Mark? I mean, if you look at not just the infamous Navalny Berezovsky photo, remember the Nemtsov phone tap scandal that happened around the same time, where they tapped Nemtsov's phone, and the opposition was quickly able to turn this around. From a discussion about what Nemtsov was saying on the phone, he was using bad language. I don't think it comes to anybody as a surprise that Nemtsov uses bad language, anybody that's ever talked. Right.
Don't speak it today. It's today's International
Women's Day. Of course. Yeah. We won't say what he said on the podcast. But Mark, have the authorities lost their monopoly on this, or did they ever have one? It seems to me they did.
Oh, they did, definitely. I mean, once upon a time, firstly, the platforms were much more sort of monolithic and state-controlled, and secondly, the information wasn't. And thirdly, there wasn't really an opposition that was trying to use these tactics. In this respect, I think Kirill's absolutely right about the potential dangers. Because I think on one level, I think the authorities are quite happy with this sort of constant flow of nonsense, quite frankly. Because if nothing else, it is like advertising. And after a certain point, I think the public does indeed filter most of it out. Plus also, often it may be in plain sight, but like the whole, you know, Roman and the family, it's encoded in such a way that it's really for elite eyes. Mm-hmm. But the risk of that is precisely what it does is it delegitimizes not just the authorities, but politics as a whole. It makes the risk is the appearance that everyone looks like they're a fraud and everyone looks like they're a phony. And in this respect, I think I can understand why the opposition like to use these tactics, because it's cute and it's fun and it's that sense that you can really make an impact. And also, to be honest, I think it speaks to the kind of people who are in the opposition at the moment. They are precisely, the kind of generation, the kind of class that believe in marketing and social media and that kind of thing, rather than trudging round grim, collapsing apartment blocks, knocking on doors and trying to persuade voters one by one. But I think the issue is, while the authorities definitely have lost their monopoly, their ability to actually shape these hidden and informal political debates, I think the danger is not that therefore it becomes contested, that it becomes another arena of politics. The danger is precisely just conveys the sense that everyone is just smearing everyone else and you can't really believe anyone, doesn't matter if they're in government or not. It's just simply a case of, one bunch of crooks against another.
So that benefits the authorities in this environment.
Yeah, it does ultimately because, the next best thing to having public support is public apathy, mm-hmm. if you are the incumbent.
Now, these kinds of things tend also to there tends to be an uptick in this kind of activity in periods of political uncertainty. I mean, if you think of the height of this in the Yeltsin period, and the archetypical example of it was the old Chelvek, Kotori Pohoj na Skoratov, the scandal that we've discussed many times on this, the famous video of Yuri Skoratov or somebody who looks like him allegedly with a prostitute. And there were many others in those days as well. But these things tend to have an uptick in periods of political uncertainty. There's been an uptick in it lately, for sure, which is why we're doing this podcast right now. Is this again indicative of the political uncertainty we're in right now?
I think so, very much. I mean, I think the point is exactly that this is a time of uncertainty. This is a time of perceived opportunity, therefore, by some. It's not yet the situation in which it's safe to be campaigning openly. You may think that Putin sort of doesn't yet have such a tight grip, but nonetheless, he clearly has a strong enough grip that if you look as if you're challenging his position as the pivotal figure, mm-hmm. You will be slapped down. So this is, in a way, it's stage one. It's before you move to the case of, I don't know, the FSB beginning to arrest Federal Drug Service officers and that kind of real open political conflict. This is just that initial stage in which you just simply sort of start trying to build your alliances. It's a way in which you can publicly practice politics without sort of openly doing so. And therefore, I think it's both a sort of a symptom as well as the way in which elite politics are being run at the moment.
So first the Pakazuka and then the battle. So we're in the run up to the battle right now.
The Fenley War,
right, Kirill?
I think it's a very important PR problem and maybe aim or reason, the main reason of Putin and his political experts and supporters, because if society observe all these, dirty tricks and scandals and rumors and provocations, which includes not only, government officials or pro-official journalists, and but also an opposition and so on. This is one sphere, a quasi-public sphere. That's one. And in opposite, like contrast to all these things, is a solid, steady, respectable, little bit archaic state regime. And that is, I think, the main point of recent game of presidential administration. They are not afraid to be involved in this, all the scandals and so on, because there are several bureaucrats who involve in this, like Rogozin and so on. But the state itself, regime itself, Putin himself, they are very distanced from all these things. And in some, PR sense, that is very successive, tactics and even maybe strategy. Because for the most part of Russian population, I agree with Mark, it's obvious that there are some, field of dirty tricks and so on. And that is the field of state. And that's serious. That's serious. It could be ineffective. That could be, corruption there and so on. But it exists, and it exists without, all the scandals and so on. It's another PR environment in some sense.
I mean, we've talked here about the deep state. We've talked about the fake state. And now we seem to be talking about the virtual state almost.
Yeah.
And, I mean, one of the things that's coming out of this is one of the ways the elite talks to each other. This is the elite's conversation going on right now. If you look at the Dvorkovich incident, it is clearly that, as Mark pointed out, that's what it is. Do either of you see any meta themes in what the elite is saying to each other right now? What is the elite talking about right now? What are the headlines? Do you see any, Mark?
Well, I think in some ways, it's clear that nationalism is one of the sort of underlying themes. I mean, if you look at, for example, the whole Medvedev recent sort of scandal, it was about the notion that he was unpatriotic, that he wasn't supporting Russian interest, and we've had suggestions that he's been giving away bargain basement oil opportunities to the Nordics and so forth. But again, I think in part that reflects, and to go back to the sort of one of the points that's just been made. The one figure who is clearly absent from all of this has been Putin. No one sort of uses any of this Pakazuka against him. And even, frankly, the opposition, although they're up for a little bit of light mockery, they tend to leave Putin alone. I think they realize that maybe it's perhaps too dangerous or whatever. And so in that respect, I think that actually nationalism becomes a code word for kind of, shall I say, presidential ambitions and higher expectations, that you want to tarnish your rival as being not a proper defender of Russian national interests. You want to build yourself up as that, because you can't call yourself a potential president in waiting. But on the other hand, if you can build, because given that sort of how central nationalism is to Putin's legitimating myth. So I think that's one of the themes that comes out. But on the whole, I don't think there is at the moment at least, any clear sense of leitmotifs, themes, or whatever that dominate. I think it's still much more the level of personality. And in some ways, last point I make is that actually, in some ways, it doesn't matter what you say. If you can throw some mud and it sticks, mm-hmm. then you have shown the other person is weak, regardless of quite what that mud involved.
Right, and in the case with Dvorkovich, it's like people aren't going to believe the guy's Twitter feed anymore. Or you're going to think twice before you believe Dvorkovich's Twitter feed. Another meta theme I see out there is the preliminaries of the succession battle. Do you see much of that, Kirill?
Oh, I think we are trying to, you know, to decode and interpret Kabbalistic text of, you know, pre-Socratic ancient Greece philosophers. I don't know. It's just a fragment of the consciousness, not, you know, a manifestation of the consciousness. But I think that it's too early to speak about the successor and so on.
They are clearly thinking.
Who knows? Maybe that if we return to the beginning of a discussion, maybe it's a psychological problem of Russian power, of Russian state, or close friends of Putin. Because of course, succession is an obsession of every authoritarian regime. In any moment of its existence, because it's not legitimate,
right?
In full, yes, but not partly. It could be legitimate with the help of some elections and so on, but a hidden idea of the very existence of authoritarian regime that it's not legitimate. And we have to cope with this problem somehow, to decide what to do when this and this and this, will die and so on. So the thing which we see now, even in Venezuela, where Chavez had a huge public support, but even in this case, it's not a case of Putin. It's not the case of Putin.
Well, no, but what Chavez didn't have was health, which Putin does have.
God knows. But anyway, I think that it's psychology, not kind of thing for political analysis. Mm-hmm. They're just obsessed with the power and with the succession of power. Mm-hmm. And the problem of opposition or liberal, journalists and the experts and so on, is that they think all the time about their succession of power, about their future end of next Putin term, and so on. They are not thinking about the recent times, about today.
But what strikes me in all of this, I mean, Putin was he was only elected a year ago this week, what strikes me about all this is, they are clearly, a lot of this jockeying is around succession, and it's pretty damn early for that to be happening, which makes me wonder what's going on. But that's, again, you're right. We're decoding hieroglyphics here. There's one thing I did want to get into before we moved into the next section, and it's a nice little segue into the next section. And this is something that's always fascinated me that the Russian authorities do quite well. And that's what's called dramaturgia, right? Creating these set pieces, these fake scandals, these fake situations, these fake narratives, and the Kremlin is extremely good at this. And during Putin's first stint in the Kremlin, right from the time of the establishment of the regime's legitimizing myth of Putin as the man on the white horse that will lift Russia up off its knees and stop the Caucasus uprising and put the oligarchs in jail. I mean, they were just very, very good. If you remove whatever moral considerations you have of this, they were very effective at accomplishing that. They were very good at creating this image of a Russia surrounded by enemies and that Putin was the only one that could save us from them. I'm remembering one of his big press conferences or one of his call-in shows with voters back in, I believe it was 2007. And Putin was talking about something Madeleine Albright allegedly said, that it wasn't fair that Russia had all this oil, that one country shouldn't have all this oil, and that that she had said this, and this is indicative of how the world wants to take away our natural resource wealth. And he used this to launch into this, to his normal spiel. Well, this kind of caught my interest. I was like, did Albright say that? And I looked, I Googled until I was blue in the face and my eyes were blurry, and I couldn't find any evidence of Albright saying this. I called Albright's office, and there was they had no recollection of Albright ever. She never said it.
Sure.
And I found out, where did this originate? It originated some blog that was written by some pro-Kremlin blogger that got into Rossiyskaya Gazeta, the pro-government paper, the government's official paper.
It's official.
And then but this suddenly became real. It became axiomatic that Albright said this, and this became part of this meta-narrative. But my point here is not that Putin lies. We know he does. My point is here is that this is part of a very effective strategy. Is Russia still good at dramaturgia? Is the Kremlin still good at dramaturgia, Mark? Or are they losing their mojo here?
We touched on the extent to which actually the political deftness of the first Putin term has been replaced by a sort of very sort of clumsy approach. It's a sort of from deftness to deafness, really. I don't really see that. I mean, in some ways, we can even actually look at the handling of domestic corruption cases. You know, take Serdyukov's ouster and the sort of the whole Oboronservice corruption scandal. This is a classic case that could have been handled in such a way precisely if Putin had wanted to show that he was getting a grip on corruption seriously. And at first it looked as if that was going to be the case. Suddenly there were all these scandals being sort of opened up, all these investigations. You know, again, this looked as if it was precisely being set up to be the kind of the pivotal Putin takes charge, Putin clears out the stables. And look what's happened. It's devolved into a sort of a muddy, murky, no one's really quite sure what's going on. There's a bunch of investigations taking place, but none of them actually seem to be making any real progress. Serdyukov himself hasn't been induced to sort of publicly fall on his sword, nor has he been sacked. He's actually just simply sitting there.
But he's not been...
ousted in some kind of, you know, gratuitous sort of the usual kind of Putin demonstrative manner. It's just become muddy and messy. Mm-hmm. And I think we are seeing this. And in part, you can say, well, it's because, you know, in the modern world, there are so many more channels for information. It becomes harder to really sort of manage everything well. But I think, you know, it does represent a growing inability on the part of the Kremlin to manage the story. Sochi, for example, again, you know, this is meant to be, the Winter Olympics are meant to be one of the big showcase projects that show what Russia can do. And we've talked about sort of Putin going there and showing his, you know, dissatisfaction with progress, which again is a classic Putin thing. The Tsar turns up and says, come on, guys, get this sorted. But at the same time, you know, what we're actually seeing is increasingly bad news stories coming out of Sochi.
Yep.
The current suggestion that $500 million has been embezzled from it. Well, which, to be honest, if only 1% of what's been spent on Sochi has been embezzled, that makes it the best run project. Yes. it's not being framed in those terms. All the opportunities to demonstrate the usual sort of cycle or arc, shall we say, of these dramas is people who are not Putin do bad stuff, and whether it's foreigners or whether it's incompetent ministers or whatever, Putin becomes aware of this suddenly and immediately sweeps in, takes personal command, and in short order the problem is fixed. And what we're actually seeing is that arc just isn't happening. No. I mean, you know, there's a problem. Putin then makes some statements, but then nothing happens.
Yeah.
And again, I think this is the real problem is, you know, the arc has to be completed to work. And at the moment, all it actually does is it demonstrates the weaknesses and the problems.
Well, yeah, the big difference I see is in Putin's first stint in the Kremlin, the Kremlin was the master of the pachazuka. The Kremlin was the master of the dramaturgia. You had a meta-narrative that was just relentlessly pounded into the public's head. What you have, and I mean, from the Chechen War to the Khodorkovsky case to the G8 summit in Petersburg, now what you have is a lot of micro-pachazukas and micro-dramaturgies and So, and that again is a symbol of the Kremlin losing its mojo, for lack of a better term. I mean, there was a piece in Moscow News, Mark, where you write a column, I know. There was a piece about contrasting, again, the Surkov style and the Volodin style, and it was played off on the 50 shades of gray metaphor, and they said, you know, Surkov had 50,000 shades of gray, but now there's only one. I see this as an example of, again, the era of political uncertainty we seem to be going into. Kirill, last word to you before we go to the second half.
The best expert in such things in Russian history and politics is, I'm not, you know, fresh. This opinion isn't fresh. It's Russian literature. One of the best Russian novels in 20th century is Andrei Bely's Petersburg. Mm-hmm. Petersburg. And the main subject of this novel is, modernist chef-d'oeuvre of Russian literature. The main subject of it is these small provocations and small rumors which are becoming real and mm-hmm. becoming the fabrics of, life and public and so on during the Petersburg period of Russian history.
The virtual state.
Yes, virtual state. And one of the main heroes, he is a senator, Ablyuchov, senior of this novel. He is writing, the positions and so on. And he even can't imagine all this parts of the country. Oh. Never saw them. And people there who live there in Kamchatka and so on, they never, not just saw, of course, but never thought about, the very existence of this Ablyuchov senior and so on. And then some revolutionaries, they entered the game and establishing a field of rumors, provocations, murders, and so on. And the outcome is a revolution. Mm-hmm. And that is very interesting because I'm not speaking that, everything which was described by Russian literature is real. But in this sense, it's one of the most realistic description of this tradition of Russian history. And it's very interesting, the term which was invented by Andrei Bely, idle mind games. Mm-hmm. Праздные мозговые игры, idle mind games. It's all about Russian politics.
And it has taken over Russian politics and takes over in periods of uncertainty. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion of Pachazuka and Agitprop and take a look at a couple of television programs making waves this week. I'd like to remind you are listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian service. And on the Skype line from New York City is NYU professor Mark Galeotti, an expert on Russian security services and author of the must-read blog In Moscow Shadows. I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical.
Кто он такой?
Гениальный финансист.
Мистер Уильям Браун.
Конечная цель. Наживу любой ценой.
Как он делал свое состояние?
Это можно назвать преступлением века.
Как воровали миллиарды из российской казны.
Браудер-то сам в курсе всего этого был или нет?
И почему Уильям Браудер еще на свободе?
Кто он такой, Уильям Браудер? Some call it investigative journalism, some call it crude agitprop. But one thing's for certain. The politically charged documentaries popping up on Russia's state-controlled television channels in recent years probably tell us more about the Kremlin's concerns of the moment than they do about their subjects. Back in September 2007, a report on the Russia channel, titled Velvet.ru, alleged that the CIA was planning to overthrow the Kremlin elite with an orange-style uprising in Russia. The Anatomy of Protest series last year on NTV charged that the protest movement that emerged in Russia in late 2011 and in early 2012 was financed by the West and orchestrated by the West. In this week, NTV aired Browder's List, a documentary alleging that William Browder, CEO of Hermitage Capital Management, illegally obtained shares in Russia's natural gas monopoly, Gazprom. William Browder, of course, is the one that's pushing Western governments to enact a so-called Magnitsky law that would sanction Russian officials over the death in custody of attorney Sergei Magnitsky. Kirill, let's begin with you. First of all, how effective are these documentaries? Do people believe these things? How effective are they?
It's questionable, and we have to divide several parts of the problem. First of all, we have to agree that the quality of this new agitprop and so on is very poor, extremely poor. I can compare it to Soviet times, but
it's much slicker.
Yes,
it's much,
yes. Soviet propaganda was much better. I'm not nostalgic about this, but it was much better. But at the same time, every word spoken on TV screen is an absolute truth for some part of Russian audience. There are several Russias, as we discussed several times, and for this part of Russian audience, or for this particular part of Russian society, that's true. Everything which they, saw on TV screen, watch on TV screen, everything is true because this is TV. Mm-hmm. It's not because it's state TV or something like this. They can see, an ad about magnificent, qualities of some, tea grown in Siberia, and then they not believe it. But these things are, they exist. Mm-hmm. They exist in this mind. And it's very important, the very existence of these things. Not that William Browder
stole Gazprom shares
or he, killed, Jesus Christ or something like this. But this statement exists in this mind.
Mm-hmm.
Not true, not lies, but exist mm-hmm. as a phenomena. And that's very important because human consciousness, human mind, has to, return to several things which are already exist there. Mm-hmm. You cannot think about the things you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But now you know that there is some problem with some, Browder.
Some William Browder.
Yes,
yeah.
And there is a problem with some, Orange Revolution style, Orange style revolution, yeah? And there are some problems with certain Magnitsky and so on. And then in everyday life and conversations and so on, it can occur to you
mm-hmm.
that... it likes
it's like
Magnitsky.
A virus.
Yes, it's like a virus in some sense. It's just opposite the way of propaganda or information or whatever, streaming through social networks and so on. It's opposite. It's TV.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it exists, and a lot of Russian audience just stick to the mm-hmm. TV screens.
Mark?
Yeah, I think that's very much the way to think about it. I mean, on the surface, so many of these kind of reports are absolutely ridiculous. I particularly was delighted by the notion that Bill Browder became a British citizen so that he could join the British Secret Service, which, as we know, is every billionaire's dream. But again, the purpose of these programs is not, I would suggest, to persuade people. It's not actually as a sort of lay down. So someone who up to that point had thought one thing to convince them the other. It's actually to a large extent to speak to those who are already convinced, or at least already in a position where they're willing to be convinced, or at least exactly to sort of, again, in this way, as Kirill was saying, the story becomes reality. Layer in little factoids, little implications and so forth. And in some ways, I'm actually reminded of the way that the Russia Today TV network works in the United States. I mean, there is, firstly, it's often very, very sort of glossy and well done. And there is some good journalism on there. However, there is also a sort of, a vast array of thoroughly bizarre stuff in which they sort of pull out freaks and conspiracy theorists who will sort of come and sort of aver exactly, along the lines of Madeleine Albright wants Russian oil, something like that. And, I and a lot of people like me be, watching it and thinking, dear God, what is this nonsense? But the point is you've laid that meme out there it permeates generally the consciousness of those people who are already willing to believe the worst of the West. It creates uncertainties. And the point is, it then gets reused. And that's, but again, it's just like the point you made earlier about the Albright thing, is that, you know, someone mentions something on a blog, it then gets picked up, it then gets used in a more authoritative position, and before you know it, it suddenly become almost read into the record as if it definitely happens, until someone actually bothers to go and dig. And even then, when you find out that it's wrong, it doesn't matter, it's already out there. Once things are out in sort of the infosphere, you can't ever catch them up and stop them. So, I mean, I think in this respect, although it's laughable, I think... as part of the whole sort of drama and theatricality of these documentaries, they just throw out stuff and hope that some of it will stick in places where you'd like it to stick.
But there is some rhyme and reason to it, in that they do kind of show us what's bothering the Kremlin at any point in time. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm sure, you know, I imagine that for Bill Browder, it's a mark of pride that he's been so sort of targeted. Yeah, I mean, it shows what the neuralgic points are. But I think it also shows how they want to portray the enemy. I mean, I think because that's all of these things are very much about identifying the enemy. First of all, it was that the Americans were trying to sort of, you know, create a new color revolution. Then when the opposition was much more sort of coherent, it was to show that the opposition were cynics or else, again, you know, tools of the West. And now it's actually sort of Bill Browder. And again, going back to sort of Soviet era, it's almost like that sense of the bad sort of international capitalism that's encircling the Russians. So, I mean, I think it definitely gives us a sense of the Kremlin's enemy picture or how it wants to portray itself.
It also, to me right now, it shows me how much the Magnitsky law in the U.S., which was recently passed in the U.S., really bothers the Russians, and how much they're worried about potentially the Europe. Because what's Browder doing right now is he's lobbying the Europeans to pass a similar version of the law to what the U.S. passed. And this would really hit the Russian elite much harder than the U.S. law did, because let's face it, the Russian elite likes to go to Europe much more than it goes to the U.S., so the visa ban would hit them a lot harder. And more importantly, their assets are more in European banks than they are in American banks. So they're quite nervous about that. There was another thing that popped up this on NTV, is there's this new satire program about Putin. I don't know if either of you have read about it.
I read about it.
But it's interesting. Now, this is not the first satire program out there about Russia. There has been some kind of tame permitted satires. But when I started to see this, I was beginning to wonder if this is a part of the Putin rebranding exercise as well, as kind of the Vladimir the Wise kind of, you can make fun of him now. He's not Vladimir the Scary anymore. What do you think? Is that what's going on here?
I think that this is not a very important thing for this part of population, which, you know, look at computer screen. Yeah,
right.
That's for a TV audience. TV audience, just, you know, not we, but experts, especially Kremlin experts, they think that is the most, you know, supportive part of the Russian population. Mm-hmm. And I think that the decision was, okay, we can play with them. We can play with them in some, you know, limits. In some limits, we can play with them, not to be, you know, not just so scary, but so boring. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting that it's again we are speaking about psychology, not about politics. Mm-hmm. I think my favorite idea that now we have a psychology or social psychology instead of politics in Russia. It's all about, you know, quick psychological reactions to some events. It's not about strategies. It's not about ideology. It's not about all this stuff.
Again, micro-narratives instead of meta-narratives.
Yes, yes. And in some, I think that was an outcome of some, you know, quick psychological reaction. Someone, you know, in Kremlin told, okay, they're, you know, bored to death with all this, you know, patriotic things and so on. We have to be, you know, a little bit milder, smoother, or, you know, a little bit funny. So let's go with this. Mm-hmm. And don't forget about another thing, about corruption. Every TV program has its own budget, and this budget could be, you know, распилен.
Yes, Mark.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this new program isn't quite exactly a successor to the puppet show.
Well, this is the irony, because one of the first things Putin did was he shut down Kukli. Go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. But and the interesting thing that I noticed, I mean, I hadn't had a chance to actually see it, but is that they made a point of mentioning that Putin had got to see it before it was aired. Now, I mean, the day when Jon Stewart runs his jokes past the White House is a long way from us. So again, it's this funny mix of, on the one hand, wanting to show, look, you know, actually we're only human, you know, we too can laugh at ourselves, but at the same time still that very kind of apparatchik type approach that says, but on the other hand, we do expect to be able to see this first, carrying with it the implication of veto power. So yeah, I mean, you know, it's at least a sort of a slight indication of an awareness that it's worth showing that you have a human side, but it's a pretty limited one.
One historical fact. First satirical journal magazine in Russia had been founded by Ekaterina II, who was editor-in-chief.
Really?
And I think the only writer in this.
And it was a satirical journal.
Yes. About court, imperial court, uh-huh. And all these things. So that's, I think, the roots of this problem.
All right. Well, we're coming to the end here. Last thoughts on the this virtual world we're living in now, Mark.
Well, I mean, given this is a power vertical where we've covered Catherine II, Kabbalist scholars, and Venetian secret police, it's clearly sort of casting the net very widely. I mean, I think that's the whole point, casting the net widely. I think what we're seeing at the moment is, as you said, there's no central narrative. And in part, that just simply reflects the nature of the modern world and the variety of different channels. But I think it also does represent a certain sort of crisis of strategy in the Kremlin. And the extent to which, and again, going back to this business about the fact that, you know, all we're seeing is just one form of elite discourse when we look at what's public. We are left like Kremlinologists in the old Soviet days. Mm-hmm. We are just looking at the headlines of Pravda and trying to work out what's actually going on behind the Kremlin walls on the basis of that. Well, likewise, I think, you know, we're piecing a lot of things together. But the fact that there is so much that we're piecing together and the fact that there is no central narrative really, to me, underlines that discord and dissonance currently taking place, you know, that currently exists within the elite.
That's part of the fun, although it often slows me down when I want to get a blog post together because I got to figure out what the hell is actually going on first. Kirill?
So, psychology and technology instead of classic politics, microprose instead of classic novel, the absence of, you know, general narrative. I totally agree with the Mark. And an absence of strategy on the both sides of Russian so-called politics.
Okay. And that, unfortunately, is all we have time for today. I would like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me has been my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian service. And on the Skype line from New York City has been NYU professor Mark Galeotti, an expert in Russian security services and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Thanks for the great discussion, guys.
My pleasure.
My pleasure.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Buturin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and definitely should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now I leave you, as always, with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.